Our blessed Lord gives his apostles the great commandment, this new commandment. He says, love one another as I have loved you. Now, this event that we just heard from in chapter 13 of John is from Holy Thursday night. Remember, St. John devotes 5 of his 21 chapters to the Last Supper. So if you have an old calendar or have seen this in the past, you might see on Holy Thursday, sometimes they'll have it listed not as Holy Thursday on the calendar, but if you have a secular calendar, let's say you have, like, you know, your favorite cat's calendar or your race cars or your sports team, it sometimes will say Maundy Thursday. Maybe you've seen that before on a calendar. The word Maundy is Old English from the Latin mandatum, which means command, and it's basically at the Last Supper where Jesus gives his apostles this new commandment to love one another as I have loved you. So it's important for us to be aware of how Jesus loves, because when we see how Jesus loves, that can be the litmus test, in fact, is the litmus test for understanding how we love one another. And I'll point out in a few seconds some areas where certainly there is room for improvement. So let me place some words and some phrases out there to describe Jesus' love. It's sacrificial to the death. It's always in conformity to the will of the Father. Jesus, when he loves, wills the good of the other as other, regardless of the cost to himself. We know that from the cross. And then finally, we can say that Jesus loves completely and selflessly. So these are characteristics of Jesus' love. Yet, we find that there are areas where love today is often mistaken for other things, but called love nonetheless. So let me point out a few examples. The first would be the person who says, I don't need to go to Mass. I pray on my own, and God knows my heart. All right. Now, that's problematic in any number of ways. For starters, the commandment is keep holy the Sabbath. That's the third commandment. And for Catholics, that means at least going to Mass. So already someone's starting to get off the tracks there. But it goes even deeper because, for example, if that person has a spouse whose faith is teetering, or you have children, obviously this is giving bad example. If two individuals, like two guys, are roommates, or they share an apartment, and they're both Catholic, and one of them goes to church and the other doesn't, it's dragging the other person down. So we may think of it in simple terms, just math terms. I'm Asian, so I always have to put this in math terms. Okay. God asks us to give up 1 hour out of 168 in a week. 24 times 7 is 168 hours in a week. So if you divide 1 over 168 and you round up generously, that's 0.006 of your week. So when people say, I'm too busy, I don't have time, I often say to them, could you be more ungrateful? You can't come back for 0.006 of your week just to say thank you. And by the way, this is the God to whom we owe our very existence. Do we lack that generosity? Or similarly, you might hear people say that I don't have to go to Mass because they'll say, I'm spiritual, but not religious. I'm spiritual, but I'm not religious. Yet they claim that Christ will save them. Which is very funny because Christ was very religious. He went to the temple, he went to synagogue, he observed all righteousness as a Jew. And in fact, we can say that we have a hard time believing and imagining that Jesus set up the church so that no one would practice the faith. I mean, I can imagine him telling St. Peter, you are Peter, and on this rock I'll build my church. And by the way, if no one wants to come, it's okay because they can just be spiritual and not religious. I mean, that's just absurd. So the people who claim that Christ is going to save them and claim not to be religious because I don't like organized religion. Well, good luck with that. Seriously, because Jesus is really into organized religion. He was as a Jew, and he certainly set it up that way in the church. So the other side of it, of course, when you don't go to Mass and you give bad example and you just decide that you're not going to go, you also may want to consider this. And again, perhaps these words are really not for you, but for persons you know. So I'm helping you articulate a case to be made to those who don't go, because you obviously do. So think of it in these terms. Let's say I'll pick a nationality and ethnicity. Well, since I live with two of them, let's pick Italian. Okay? Let's say you're Italian. Okay? All right. And so I ask you, as an Italian American, and I say to you, your heritage is from Italy, yes. I said, now, how long has your family been Catholic? And they count back and say, well, probably all the way to the early church, I would guess, you know, till, you know, maybe to the time of St. Peter, when the faith came, you know, to Rome. And I said, okay, that's over 60 generations. If a generation is 30 years, we're talking about over 60 generations of your family have been Catholic. All the way down the line. Because there's no way that, well, it's possible for you to have become Catholic outside of that, but likely you were Catholic, your whole family's been Catholic, all its history. Oh yeah, definitely, Father. So it stops with you? Over 60 generations of your family have been Catholic, and it stops with you. I tell you what, if you knew my grandmother, and that's why I tell my cousins and my sibling, my sister, if you met my grandma in heaven, it stops with you. Mm-hmm. You may not want to go to heaven, but you have to meet her. So, you know, it's really, I mean, people have to, I think we're very, very poor students of history today. We don't have a sense, we don't feel the burden, and I don't mean that in a bad sense, but the weight of family tradition. We've always done it this way. And, of course, if they're Italian, I'd say, well, are there any martyrs in your family? Have you ever done the research? Maybe, you know, some of your family members died for the faith. I mean, they must be rolling over in their graves. You won't even go to church. They died for it. How do you explain that? I mean, even if you don't like to go to church, maybe you could just spend an hour just to say thanks, just to acknowledge that, you know, without God, I wouldn't even exist, and just to say, I appreciate all that you've given me. Help me to grow in love for you. Case number two. This happens a lot with children, both young children and adult children with older parents. Here's the line. If you don't give me what I want, or you don't agree with me, you must not love me. If you don't give me what I want, or you don't agree with me, you must not love me. Now, parents know this very well. You may come back to your child and say, no, I'm saying no precisely because I love you. It happens in parishes. How many times will I ask people reasonable requests? I take them outside after Mass. I tell them, could you please use the cry room? Could you be considerate of other people in the church? We make appointments and we talk to people. We try to pastorally guide them to see. And what do? They pick up their toys and they go to another parish. I refuse to submit to this request. It's unreasonable. Okay, it would be unreasonable if I singled you out during Mass and embarrassed you in front of the entire congregation. That would be unreasonable. Or if I raised my voice at you or I yelled at you, yes, that would be unreasonable. Or if I hadn't gotten complaints from about 40 other parishioners who go to that Mass that there are too many children crying inside the church when the cry room is available. But no. We're living in your world. We're just guests. See, that's not the love Jesus has in mind, I'm quite sure, from the gospel this morning. And it certainly happens also very painfully, I know, from experience, with parents who have adult children who are deciding to get married outside the church. Oh, a great source of pain in that family. Because the parents will not attend the wedding. The marriage is invalid. It is de facto invalid. They are ripped to shreds. You can imagine why. Your daughter, your son's getting married, but you can't go because the marriage is not valid. They're not marrying in the church. And who's the bad guy? Mom and dad. Because they're standing up for the faith. So they're the ones with the problem, not the person living in that sinful situation. Speaking of living in sinful situations, example number three. Cohabiting among couples today. It seems to be the norm prior to marriage. It's rare that we get individuals who come to us for marriage preparation who are not already living together as if they are husband and wife. And I try to remind them, because I tell them, do you love each other? They say, yes. You really love each other? Yes. I said, do you will the best for your fiancé, your future spouse? Yes. Okay. What's the best possible thing for them when we consider eternity? Heaven. Okay. But right now, the way you're living does not admit you going there, because you're living in sin. It's a phrase I think we still all know, right? Living in sin. So they say, well, I love them. If you love them, you would not risk their souls to mortal peril. You would not put them in a near occasion of sin. You would not be in a near occasion of sin yourself. You would love them by saying, because I love you, we will not live together and give scandal, and we will wait till we're married. Because I love you. Not because I don't love you, but precisely because I love you. So these couples come to us asking for marriage preparation, which is really catechesis. It's formation in the sacrament. But 9 out of 10 of them are not ready for catechesis, to learn about the sacrament. What they need, actually, is not catechesis. They need evangelization, which means they still need to be converted to the gospel. So imagine this, right? They haven't gone to church really since college, and now they're in their late 20s, early 30s, getting married. And all of this time, their entire value system has been deformed and formed by other sources. So now they want a sacrament. In many cases, what they really want is a wedding, not a sacrament. And they want us to be the puppet, to stand at the front and pretend it's really wonderful and great. And then when we actually instruct them in the sacrament, then they pick up their toys and go somewhere else. If you don't give me what I want, you must not love me. Love is tough, no doubt. Lastly, marriage. Now, I'm not going to touch the alleged forms of marriage that others are espousing today and that the Supreme Court is pondering its legality. That's another homily for another day. But perhaps just a word about traditional marriage between a man and a woman. Traditional marriage is on the decline. It is. Less people today of marrying age are actually getting married. What is increasingly becoming more common are civil unions or just living together in common law marriages. But marriage, as we understand it, is an eroding institution. And I suppose in a certain sense, we might blame the divorce culture for some of this, but it may even go even deeper than that. I think, and these are just my personal musings on the issue, somewhere along the lines, and I don't know where it happened, I don't know the source per se, but somewhere along the lines, attitudes on marriage changed quite a bit. Traditionally speaking, the purpose of marriage is the begetting and rearing of children. That is the primary ends of marriage. But somewhere along the lines, society as a whole decided that the primary ends of marriage is personal fulfillment. That's the primary ends of marriage in the new model. And you see, then if that's your model, and you can separate marriage from having kids, and once that relationship no longer is personally fulfilling to you, then I could understand why you'd want to leave. So then why bother getting married and legally bind yourself to this person, because their personal fulfillment points might run out? You see, there's something wrong in marriage, of course. In fact, it's a happy consequence. It should be a happy consequence of marriage that you're personally fulfilled. But to a man, if you ask any parent, mother or father, what's the most fulfilling thing you've done in your life? Had kids. It should be. I mean, careers come and go, places where you live come and go, work can vary. But one thing that won't is that once you have that child, I mean, that child is in your care. That child's life has totally changed yours. Every parent knows that. So it's great to be personally fulfilled in marriage, and that should be a happy consequence of its primary ends, which is having kids in the first place. But again, it's not surprising then that people aren't marrying, because personal fulfillment is the goal.
So why enter an institution that will bind you to someone who might not personally fulfill you? It's time to leave your options open so that you can have other opportunities on the outside. There are many, many other examples where love in the world is not up to snuff. I mean, I could go on, but there's no point. In the end, we have to say this. If we really want to know what love, as Jesus mandated in the upper room, really means, and what it's all about, then we need to spend more time in front of a crucifix. If we really want to know what love is, this is the greatest love man will have ever known. It's not romantic. It's not easy. It is not selfish or narcissistic. But it is the antidote to all of the lack of love I cited in the aforementioned five examples. So we do well to pray today and every day for the grace to love one another as Jesus loved us, selflessly, sacrificially, in conformity to the will of the Father, and willing the good of the other as other, regardless of its cost to us. If we are seriously committed to this, and people see this as we live our lives in charity, in love, then people will know that we are in fact His disciples. O Mary, conceived without sin,